Good morning. Knowing that you are all perspicacious, you will have studied your card, you will see that the chair on your card has metamorphosed into something quite different. Well, not quite different, but something other. I'm not going to apologise for it because I think we've got the better of the bargain. Basically, the chair we were going to have here when we planned all these a while ago has been selected for what's going to be an extraordinary, I think, exhibition here at the museum in the autumn, which our guest, Dr. Amin Jaffa, is one of the curators of, and it's sort of, as it were, in the sick bay, so to speak, at the V&A, being got ready for its moment of glory in the exhibition. So we have a comparable chair, but a chair with, as I think you're going to discover, a very different and a rather richer and a rather more interesting history than that chair. So, I make no apologies for having done a substitute. So, you won't have your crib sheet in front of you. You'll have to exercise your eyes as before. And we're going to wait just a moment to be told we're okay, I think, and then we'll start. I mean, you'll need to come a little closer on this side. There we go. Okay. East and West and the cultural exchange between the two is the principal theme, of course, of this year's proms. And here beside me is a fine example of that traffic. It's a magnificent ivory chair with a curved back, a generous caned seat, and five elegantly curved legs. Ivory with traces of gilt for a chair that was carved and decorated in India at the end of the 18th century, and almost certainly as a gift for an English super Saab who'd served his time and done his duty in the East. And now it's a prized possession here at the Victoria and Albert Museum in South Kensington. Well, I'm joined by the keeper of this chair, so to speak, and it's one of a pair of chairs, Dr. Amin Jaffa, exhibition curator in the research department here at the V&A and an expert on furniture from British India. Dr. Jaffa, it's carved out of solid ivory, it's got traces of gilt, and it's extraordinarily richly decorated, this chair, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the top of the line, as it were. It's the absolute finest in ivory work made in India in the late 18th century.
The sheer quality of the workmanship is the first thing that takes your breath away. I mean, this is made by very sophisticated furniture makers, craftsmen, almost artists.
Yes, almost artists. They're really ivory carvers rather than furniture makers. I think the important thing to remember is that before Europeans arrived in South Asia, people traditionally sat on textiles on the ground. And so furniture was really consisted of bolsters and cushions, etc. So the production of a Western-style elevated chair was quite a new thing to the ivory carvers, and what's remarkable is that they were so successful at duplicating the construction of Western furniture.
Where did they get their model from? I mean, if you were a well-heeled Saab working presumably at this period for the East India Company, did you simply go along and say to the ivory carver or to a carpenter in the bazaar, would you please make me six chairs? I mean, how did the process work?
It's a fascinating process. I think the thing we've got to remember is that before the 1850s or 60s, when you hired a cabin on your way out, you were required to furnish it. So you took furniture out with you, and very often you kept it when you were building a new home. So the convention in terms of commissioning something in India was to provide the artisan with what they used to call a muster, which is the model. So you'd either take along a physical chair or ask him to come home and measure it, etc., or you'd give him an engraving or an image of some sort. This is also, the 18th century is the great age of the pattern book when it comes to furniture. We think most of all of Chippendale and his great director of the 1760s, but he was only one of a number of English furniture makers who decided to publicize themselves by producing these designs. So it could have been almost anything. I mean, this chair is very, very unusual in its design. It's very clear that the makers were drawing their inspiration from a number of different sources.
Can you find one source in one pattern book as the kind of dominant one?
For this chair? Not really. No one single source. It's very clear, for example, that the palm fronds on the back and the splats with their intertwining foliage come out of a book by somebody called Robert Manwaring of the 1760s. But there are also elements, for example, the way the arms curve out very gently, that really derives from Chinese furniture. The very round and the oval seat is really inspired by French furniture, by bergères of the period. So it's very clearly a hybrid.
And the most extraordinary thing, for me at least, is in fact the legs, because there are three so-called cabriole legs, carved curled legs, and two straight bent ones at the back, but they're all linked together by a stretcher, which is kind of all meets in a kind of central piece in the middle at the bottom. That's a kind of design I've not seen before. Can you find a source for that?
Yes, I mean, round chairs of this type with 5 feet, sometimes 6 feet, were known in the East Indies as burgomaster chairs. And quite often the seats swiveled. And the idea was that these were used by the sort of the head honcho of the Dutch East India Company local factories, or the head of the settlement, as a sort of chairman. And so there's a precedent for that. And that is, again, one of the influences. What's very exciting is that when you look at this very, very closely, you see that the little stretchers are turned out of solid ivory, and they're to a very standard European form. The central component into which they're all tenoned is totally Indian in character. It's actually carved extremely, extremely delicately with a lotus flower. And so again, we have this, you know, this great contrast between the typically European and the typically Indian.
And that theme runs wonderfully, almost riotously, one might say, through all the decoration, because if you look at the seat itself, the kind of thicker bit of the seat, surely these are peacocks, aren't they, or representations of peacocks?
They're representations of peacocks. They're also seen or interpreted sometimes as palms, wide open. But again, how they contrast to the more traditional European acanthus leaf, you know, which conventionally on furniture of this period would have been on the upper legs as we have here, is what's really fascinating for me, this marriage of the two different decorative traditions.
And do you think that is self-conscious, that we have, as it were, the acanthus leaf of the West, the great Greek classical tradition, and yet we have peacocks and lotus leaves and palm leaves from the East? I mean, is this a conscious attempt to fuse these two ideas?
I don't think that the artisans who are carving this were thinking quite along those lines. I think that the chair and its decoration really represents the period, which was one of fusion in taste. And it's one in which, if you look at East India Company miniatures of the day, where you'll see Hastings sometimes seated on the ground without his shoes.
That's Warren Hastings, the great administrator.
Exactly, Warren Hastings, you know, who's connected to this chair, as it were. But the point is that in the period, the greatest East India Company officials lived a sort of hybrid life. The clothes they wore were a hybrid. Everything about their existence was. And so I think it's very natural that the ornament on their furniture was also a mixture of East and West.
So our sense of there being a frontier between East and West, between India, British India, and Europe, Britain, is really a 19th century idea, not an 18th century idea.
I think it's very much a 19th century construct. For all sorts of reasons, things change in the relationship between East and West in the 19th century. In this period, luckily, we have a very happy, very playful moment between India and Britain, particularly when it comes to lifestyle and taste and the excitement of the other and the appeal of the other.
Now, quite the most striking decorative detail we've left till last. It's at the end of these curving arms, there are what I take to be two tiger's heads that end the arm. Now, what is going on here? Because they've got, if you look at them, they've got red mouths as if they've kind of got red tongues or indeed have been savaging some poor, you know, man and drunk the blood afterwards.
Well, these are very, very fantastically carved heads of tigers, absolutely right. And because of these tiger heads, these chairs were wrongly, for a very long time, associated with Tipu Sultan, the great South Indian ruler, who was known as the Tiger of Mysore, and one of the most celebrated objects in the V&A, in the Indian Gallery, in the Nehru Gallery, is a man-eating tiger organ. It's a big model of, I'm sure you're all familiar with it, it's one of the great objects of the museum. And that object really was part of British public imagination in the 19th century. And so when these chairs were written about in the 19th century, the association between this very obvious tiger and that very obvious tiger was made, and there developed a great myth that these chairs came from the palace of Tipu Sultan.
And Tipu Sultan took the tiger as his kind of icon, his motif, did he? He
absolutely. I mean, you find tigers in the forests around Mysore, first of all, and he saw himself as a sort of tiger figure. He was a great threat to the British presence in South India. And he was also a great connoisseur of the arts. And we have a small display in the gallery downstairs, which shows you how tigers and tiger stripes were used decoratively on his arms and armor, on the uniforms of his soldiers, on the textiles, on the carpets, on his own dress, on the jewelry, on everything that came out of his court. It was really his badge. But I think it's important to note that because Tipu used it so vocally, as it were, he's associated with it. The tiger is a common symbol of royalty throughout India.
So if the old and romantic tradition was that these chairs, this pair of chairs, had been made in Tipu Sultan's great workshops in Mysore, you've exploded that. In fact, this is not the case. A fanciful idea.
It's totally fanciful. We're very, very lucky to have found a group of correspondence relating to Warren Hastings and the ruler of Murshidabad, the old princely capital of the state of Bengal. And she was the regent. She's called Mani Begum. And she was originally a dancing girl who married the Nawab. And when the Nawab died, and there was a sort of power vacuum, Warren Hastings installed her as the regent. And she thanks Hastings and his wife Marion by giving them, over a number of years, pieces of very, very, very high quality ivory furniture. And when Hastings comes back to England, it's his agent in Calcutta who's transacting the shipping of the furniture. And Hastings asks him repeatedly to give letters to the Begum to thank her or to tell her how fantastic the furniture looks in the house in Daylesford, Warren Hastings' great, great house, which he built in the Cotswolds. And that's how we really know that this piece, One of a Pair, belongs to this great, important commission.
So that means you must be fairly certain in what kind of workshop they were carved.
Well, actually, because Indian craftsmen, the craftsmen who were making this, were illiterate, you know, we have very, very little record of them. What we know about these craftsmen is really through European eyes, is through European eyes who talk about the workshops. Europeans who, when they arrive in Murshidabad, are offered little bits of ivory carving and letter openers and things like that. We actually don't have names of the makers, for example.
But there would have been a very particular tradition that of ivory carving that the Begum would have been able to access in preparing these sequence of gifts for Warren Hastings, her friend.
Absolutely, absolutely. When Murshidabad became the capital of Bengal, of princely Bengal, ivory carvers from local towns came to it. It was a new city. And they started to produce things for the court. It was very traditional in India for the ruler to provide tusks from his own elephants, which would be made into fly whisk handles, fan handles, mirror stands and mirror cases, ivory boxes, all sorts of things that were used by Indian princes. So there was very much a tradition of very, very high-level ivory carving. The great leap is for the craftsmen to apply their skills in the production of a totally different form, and one that's quite challenging, because of course a piece of furniture also has a function. It's got to stand.
And you've got to be able to sit on it, presumably.
You've got to be able to sit on it.
Now, is it true that Warren Hastings returns, where eventually he will be impeached for his supposed poor behavior in India, he returns and the Begum continues to send him these wonderful objects, but that some of them don't actually reach him?
Absolutely. Of course, we've got to remember that the shipping of objects was always a risk in the period, as it is now. And one of the great consignments of ivory furniture, I think there were four chairs and some buffalo horn chairs, all went down with a ship called the Hinchinbrook. And, you know, somewhere at the bottom of the sea, if not totally lost to us.
But I love the idea that quite, you know, perhaps almost shamefaced, Hastings simply writes back, explains to the Begum that, alas, the ship has gone down, it's foundered and her chairs are at the bottom of the ocean, but he'd be very happy to have a few more.
Absolutely. And she provides them. What's very interesting is, although Hastings was able to acquire these fairly simply because of his rank, the thing is that when these chairs came back to Britain, they created an absolute sensation. Hastings gave a pair to Queen Charlotte, and that began her life as a collector of ivory furniture from India. And pieces like this were written about in the press as sensational, as the richest and finest furniture that existed. Because of the ivory and the gold, you know, the idea of having solid ivory furniture was seen as so remarkable and so over-luxurious, really truly exotic. And it really symbolized, I think, in Britain at the time, the richness of Asia, the richness of this land of spices and silk, of diamonds in particular.
And presumably it was the idea of the exotic that was at the heart of the appeal, the idea that it wasn't something that you could have had made in a European workshop. It brought some kind of, it trailed clouds of Oriental glory and exoticism.
Absolutely. I mean, just the material itself, ivory, and again used in the solid, it just couldn't be done in the West, where you have, you know, the copying of ivory through paint finishes, as it were. So here we have the sort of the real thing, and again with the gold, it completely evokes a sense of the richness of the East.
Is it also an example of something that was taken for granted by many people in England, and certainly those who lived and served in India, that this was an ostentatious culture in India? It was an expensive culture. It was the equivalent nowadays, perhaps, if you lived in London or Paris, of talking about the cost of living in Tokyo. This was an expensive place, Calcutta.
Well, yes. The interesting thing, of course, is that men went out to India to earn their fortunes, but they found very quickly when they got there that the cost of living in India was incredibly expensive. And one of these things was the sheer number of servants you were expected to keep, because according to Indian caste traditions, servants wouldn't do any job other than what they were supposed to do, and everything was very, very closely regulated. Apart from that, because at the top level you had people who were on such vast fortunes and traders earning so much, they developed this sort of endemic high conspicuous consumption. And because, again, one was away from the metropolis, away from London, it was very easy for people to reinvent themselves and redevelop their personalities, particularly with all of this new money. And so life was extremely flashy. There's a great diary of the period written by somebody called William Hickey. And if you haven't read William Hickey of the 1760s and 70s, I would recommend him. It's very amusing. He writes about how he gets so used to the ostentatious clothes of Calcutta that when he comes back to London, he goes to the theater one evening wearing, he describes, a spangled coat. He's laughed at. But the thing is that even if you go to India today, the colors that people wear are that much brighter, the jewelry. I mean, it has a lot, I think, to do with the light, the very, very strong, harsh light.
Looking again at this chair with which we begin and end our conversation, one other idea occurs to me. There is something for all its richness of decoration, for the traces of the gilt, for the sheer flamboyance of it. There is something classical about it too, isn't there? Do you think that is part of the appeal of India in this period, that it is a classical world in some sense?
Well, I think I'd like to answer that on two levels. On one level, the aesthetic of the white and the gold appeals to the sort of neoclassical revival of the 1780s and the 1770s, absolutely. But on a deeper level, what we've got to consider is that this is a period in which there's a group of scholars, British scholars in India, who are really interested in exploring India, charting it. And the first thing they find, of course, is a subcontinent littered with monuments, with inscriptions. And they immediately start to try and decipher these. A man called Sir William Jones, who's out there, who's a linguist, who's a classicist and linguist, starts to learn Sanskrit, which is the sort of key to understanding this great heritage. And he discovers within 6 months of learning Sanskrit that, in fact, it's very closely related to ancient Greek, but that it's more sophisticated and better, he says. And there develops a great sense of India being the far older civilization, much older than the classical West. And this group of scholars started to look around them and saw people wearing unstitched clothes, saris and lungis, worshipping at altars, praying to a pantheon of gods, living in a very highly segregated social structure, and they realized that what they found is the ancient classical West still alive in the East.
So they invest it with all the feelings that they have about the glory that was Greece.
Absolutely, absolutely. They really begin to see India as the originator of the modern West.
So those who return, like Warren Hastings, who return with wonderful loot like this chair, have actually seen, unlike most of their fellow middle-class and scholarly upper-class citizens, have actually seen this Greece, the Greece that's disappeared.
Absolutely, absolutely. I must say that this moment of enlightened thinking and fascination is not a very long moment. The political changes of the early 19th century sort of sweep that ancient history under the carpet.
Dr. Amin Jaffa, thank you very much indeed.
My pleasure.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen. As always, Dr. Jaffa will stay here briefly because he's happy to talk and answer questions.